This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com.
E-scouting is the crucial first step to any great adventure, but sometimes we gotta swap the muck boots for flip-flops and the shotguns for fishing rods and get out on the water to recharge those batteries. Whether you're in search of the lunker that broke you off last summer or trying to get the family out for a day on the water, you need to have a game plan. That's where Onyx Fish comes into play. With detailed bathymetry maps, expert information, historical fisheries data, and filters that allow you to hone in on your next favorite lake for a multitude of species, this is an angler's best friend. Shoot, I'm actually planning a father-son trip to the North Woods with some buddies right now, and I already feel like I've got a game plan in place to catch more fish than the rest of those guys. And the best part is, it's easy, intuitive, and based on the same platform as our beloved Onyx Hunt app. Go check it out today and start finding your next honey hole at onyxmaps.com/fish.
Fall is here and it's time to get out in the woods, and when you do, you need gear that's going to keep you warm, dry, and concealed while you're pursuing wild game. That's why I'm proud to be partners with Huntworth Gear, the makers of badass, affordable hunting gear that's readily available and won't break the bank. You've heard me talk about this gear for years now, and for good reason. Their Heat Boost gear is the warmest hunting gear I've ever worn, and guys, I promise you, I'm not just saying that. It beats the heck out of traditional merino, fleece, or down hunting clothes. Not to mention, we've got a ton of great new camo patterns, including our new waterfowl pattern, Oberus, which has been expertly designed to keep you concealed from wary ducks flying overhead. To go get kitted out for this fall, visit huntworthgear.com or head on over to the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, hope you're all doing well. I hope the start to, I don't know what stage we're in. We're still in the transition stage of, like, we had fall, spring, got warm, now it's cold again, but also kind of warm at the same time, but it's not really good enough for anything. But whatever you're doing outside, folks, I hope you're doing doing it successfully, having some fun, learning something maybe. I realized very quickly this past weekend that I might have spent a little too much time on the trout streams during that little warm spell, because I did a little scouting and my legs definitely let me know that I've been walking around in trout streams instead of climbing up bluffs and banging around the hills and stuff. But I got in, found some really, really awesome sign on a couple of new properties and some areas that I sort of knocked around in. One of them was the one that I was on with Derek Malcor. I dove in there and kind of actually scouted the backside of where we found this really gnarly bedding area. And kind of smack dab turned out being smack dab in between two big hub scrapes on these two major drainage systems with the river down below. And I was really stoked to figure out that after I walked the top of it and I got down in the bottom of it, I checked both of those scrapes and I was kind of working back on my way back to the car, and I got down to the bottom and I looked back up towards those beds, and I realized very quickly that that bluff had this goofy little washout that was, for at least from the bottom, looked more than climbable, that I couldn't really tell from up top. When I was up there looking down, it looked like it was just a sheer cliff drop basically for 20-30 feet. But upon further inspection, well, really what drew me to it was a rub that was literally up to my shoulders, that got me super fired up. And then I looked back on the trail that it was on and happened to aim straight back up the hill to that bed. So I think I've got a rough game plan, at least for throwing one sit at that buck, if he's still around. But after that, I don't know, we'll have to see, because it's a goofy property, it's got some water on it, and I don't know, it's gonna be a thinker, that's for sure. But we're actually gonna dive into that today. I've got Zach Haas with Creek Bottom Land Management on the line today with me. But before that, real quick, I got to give a quick shout out to Wisconsin BHA. If you're looking for, if you ever thought about doing any Western hunting,
and you're looking for an intro to it or a workshop to potentially learn more about that, they're going to be hosting a intro to Western hunting event over at the Vortex headquarters on Saturday, March 7th, which is actually this coming Saturday if you're listening to this. So mark your calendars, shoot Alec a message, or go check out the BHA events page for that. And I kind of touched on it earlier. Trout season has been slowly kind of like sputtering to a start right now, but in the next couple of weeks here, as things start to stabilize, the getting's going to get really good. Fish are going to be super happy. I'm planning to knock around a couple of bigger lower stretches of some of my favorite trout streams in search of a nice big trout tomorrow, actually. So hopefully I'll have something good to report on from there. But if you want to get out on the water this spring, I'd love to take you. Go find more info at goodchanceflyfishing.com. Get your dates booked before the calendar fills up, because she is filling up quickly this year, which I'm pretty fired up about. But that said, I'd love to get more of you guys out, so get in touch. But Zach, man, thanks for sitting through that intro. I'm stoked to be chatting with you. I'm stoked to be talking about hunting whitetails around water and just learning more about that. That's something we were texting this morning. I've had a million questions and theories and stuff kind of rattling around in my head, but I've never actually talked to somebody who really knows what they're doing around it. So how are we doing today, man?
I'm doing good. It's an office day, but I wish I was out doing more habitat work, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure, man. How's the habitat season been for you so far this year?
Good overall. I mean, started off a little slow just because we had all that snow early here, but now that we had that warm up and everything, it turned the dial up to 10 now that we don't have much snow. So now it's just go, go, go.
Yeah, totally, dude. Yeah, I did a little bit of scouting myself during that snowy period there. And I'm curious, like, as a land manager, when you're obviously going out, checking on properties, doing maybe some initial consults or revisiting stuff, when there's a blanket of snow on the ground, it's a lot harder to identify like what all might be going on. Like, to an extent, it's helpful because you can see some of the fresh tracks and what they're doing late season, but identifying early season sign, maybe those early travel routes and stuff. What do you look for when you're on a property that's still got a blanket of snow on it?
Yeah, so I try to avoid snow covered properties because it hides so much habitat. It hides a lot of the story per se. But what it can do is what I do, and this is my own properties, my client properties, is I go around and I'm looking for trail systems. I'm looking for where they're bedding to tell a story, what they're browsing on. And ultimately, you know, obviously I'm looking for shed antlers too, because I'm a shed nut, as you can tell behind me. I have a bunch of sheds in my house. But with that said, I mean, it does tell a lot of story when you do have snow, especially on the woody browse. You know, I try to document what plants they're really feeding on, what I have to maybe add to a property if there isn't any browse. But also it kind of tells you, are the deer even wintering on your land or not? So that's a big one, because to me, I would say of all the mature deer I've shot, it's probably north of 80% is because I wintered them. So if I can winter deer, that just increases your odds. But I always kind of look for my trail systems. About every 3 years, I map them all. So I'll actually go through with Onyx and I walk every trail. And what that tells you is you can figure out what are temporary trails that were just made because of the season. Maybe there's a change of agriculture, change of food, whatever it might be. But then you can also tell which ones are what I call legacy trails, the trails that never change. And those are the ones I really key on when I want to get my stands or my access, all that. That tells me a lot of how I want to lay out that property.
Got it, dude. Yeah, I love that approach, because especially depending on the time of year you get out there, it seems like it's just like a spider web of trails that.
Oh, right.
And I like that emphasis on like what the legacy trail is versus just a, you know, potentially a seasonal one if they're eaten down low or up high or whatever it may be.
Right. And then you look at like Northern Wisconsin. Is so different than Southern Wisconsin, right? So like Southern Wisconsin, I can show you trails all season long. Every month I can be like, here your trails are. Northern Wisconsin, all those trails in the winter disappear in the spring because those are all snow covered, ice covered. And once they melt, you don't find those trails anymore because they're very nomadic herd when you get to Northern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You mentioned if you can winter deer, you think you can kill them. Unpack that a little bit for me.
Yeah, so to me, what I've kind of found is when I have wintered deer, and this is just my kind of thinking biologically and all that, is you just made that deer survive the toughest time of his year. After he's depleted his nutrients, he's run down from the rut. If he can truly survive on your property in the winter, well, he knows he can survive every other month on your land. so he feels the safe, because let's be honest, in the wintertime, that's when they're most vulnerable to the cold. They're vulnerable to predators, all these different things. So if he knows he can truly survive in the hardest month, I found they stick around way longer. And you start getting that history of deer because they did get through that hard month.
Sure. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that from a, I guess, a longevity standpoint. I always thought that because so many people, whether, especially if you're a public land guy, there's so many properties that like, yeah, the deer are there for the summer, early fall. Right. And after that, maybe they dip out after the rut and then they go find private ag or whatever it may be.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, I like that approach a lot. It also takes the guesswork out of figuring out, okay, when do they come back? When are they like trying to track a deer all the way up and down a you know, valley system or whatever it may be? Like that's a little beyond my knowledge, I think. But
and to me, it's like, you know, when I go on client properties, I'm always asking, when are the peaks of deer activity? When are the lows? Because, you know, the peak is fine. All right, cool. Something's working on your property for the peak, whether it be summer, fall, winter, whatever it might be. But what are the lows? When do your deer disappear? And that's what I really focus on when I try to improve properties, is those lows. If the deer are all disappearing in the summer, well, there's a reason for that. They have better summer ground somewhere. So how can we incorporate more summer habitat on your land, or vice versa, winter habitat, vice, you know? So to me, I focus on the lows and not the peaks, because we got to increase those peak, those lows, to become just as productive, let's say, as those peak year times a year.
Yeah, for sure. I've been noticing that over the past couple of days, I found a few spots that I hunted them late season in like early-ish December. I also have revisited them a couple times since then, where those red oaks are just, I mean, it looks like somebody took a garden rake through there. Oh, yeah. And part of it's the turkeys aren't, they aren't holding back either. But right, you know, right. That you've got these areas, I mean, entire hillsides that are just totally kicked up to the dirt, where they're eating these red oaks and these acorns and everything. That, I guess, the connection that I'm making just based off what we're talking about here then would be, okay, like stick a pin in that. They might not be eating on it right now, but if this is able to hold them through the rest of the year, or through that difficult part of the year, would be a good part to, or a good spot to return to come.
Absolutely.
Actual hunting season there. That's really good to know, man. Yep. I love that approach. That's some, because I've always wondered, like, okay, you find that, you know, the red oak sign, or, you know, whatever, whatever late season browse, you find that stuff in January and February, but like, what do I do with it? Like, I'm sure they're going to eat it at some point during the fall, but is it going to be like a destination thing during the season? Probably not. So no, that's awesome. Just from a, doesn't, like, not everything has to be a food plot, right? Or has to be a direct food source. Yeah, but
well, especially when you're talking like public land hunting, you can't go in there and put in all these different amenities, right? So you got to focus on what's there and what the deer. To me, I let the deer tell me most of my story, so I can really figure out, okay, this is what you guys want to do, so I got to manipulate that rather than just, I'm going to go sit here because it looks nice. Well, that's not, the deer not telling me that story. So I'm trying to find those buck beds where there's a bunch of rubs and there's beds within them and all those different things. And those are the areas then I'm like, okay, I got to work around you to make this habitat better.
Sure. Yeah, totally makes sense. You mentioned earlier, we're going to get to an intro here. I've just got a million questions right off the bat. Dude. you mentioned earlier, like going onto a property, identifying, okay, there's a lack of maybe summer habitat or food or whatever it may be that's going to hold them in the warmer months versus the colder months. Like, how do you assess that? What are you looking for? In terms of like what's going to hold deer over the summer versus over the later season?
Yeah, so like summer in particular, so we're looking for obviously high protein for food sources, because when you think about it, bucks are growing their antlers, but more importantly, the does are lactating, so they need as much nutrients as they can to produce milk. So I'm looking for high quality food sources for one, because they're going to be in that nonstop. Water sources is another biggie, especially when we get some of these drought years. If there's not good water, they're going to be moving off the property. Like, yeah, they get some from their forage, but overall, they still need 1.5 gallons of water a day. So they're going to possibly
move off. Do they really?
Yeah. 1.5 gallons of water a day. So they're not getting it off tree buds, I can guarantee you.
Right.
Now, if you have streams, rivers, it can add some, but when you have like wildlife ponds, all that, oh, that's the ticket. A lot of people call it the cheat code. But the other thing I'm looking for is type of bedding. So in the summer months, we want low stem count. You don't want a lot of brush and all these things, because deer, you know, especially bucks, when they're growing that velvet, that's super sensitive. They don't want to, they're kind of prissy when it comes to their velvet. So they don't want to be in all this stuff, raking it up, rubbing it off. So a lot of times I'll find those, you know, more open pine stands or timber stands. And a lot of times that's where they live in summer. And the other thing I'm looking for too is areas that have low insect count. So if you have a lot of deer flies, a lot of mosquitoes, the deer don't want to lay up in that either in the summer months. So they're going to find those cool areas that don't have the bugs and all that kind of stuff. That's where I want to lay up. So those are the things I'm keying in on for summer habitat.
Totally. Yeah, that makes sense. I hadn't even thought about that from a, I guess like a the buck antler sensitivity standpoint, but I guess it makes sense. I mean, how often do you see them even just like bedded out in a bean field or in some tall CRP where they've got a little bit of cover, but they can just kind of not have to worry about knocking into anything that.
Even like corn stands, they'll go in there because there's really no insects in those cornfields. Mm-hmm. It's cool. It's canopied and they can just feel safe because they're not going to wreck their antlers on a random corn stalk. So they're just going down those roads feeding and yeah, they feel safe. They have everything they need there.
Definitely, man. Well, dude, tell us a little bit about yourself. We're going to dive into water and whitetails here and kind of it's going to be our theme of the talk here today. But tell us a little bit about yourself and Creek Bottom Land Management, kind of where you're from, how you got started, and what all you do.
Absolutely. So, yeah, my name's Zach Haas. So I'm the owner of Creek Bottom Land Management and going on my 11th year of business. So it's been a fun ride. It's crazy that it's been over a decade already doing this work. But before that, I actually spent almost 20 years as an aquatic biologist. So I was working on fixing ponds, lakes, whether it be for swimming, fishing, you know, for stormwater ponds, you name it. I mean, probably every single year I was managing probably over 1,000 to 1,500 different water bodies across the state of Wisconsin.
No way.
And that was everything from, like I said, doing nutrient reduction, doing fishery health surveys and stocking, doing aeration systems, treating for algae in plants, adding bacteria and enzymes, and overall just fixing these ecosystems in our state. So that was a really fun process. Worked on the private and public sector side of it, but we were mainly private. And it just got to a point where my niche was water, and I seen that there wasn't that niche really in the outdoor industry. So I actually kind of started the business after my dad's like, hey, man, you got something special here. Why don't you bring that into your craze about whitetails? And I'm like, yeah, all right. So and I dove in, started my business, and yeah, I never really looked back since.
That's awesome, dude. Do you cover the whole state of Wisconsin or what's your range
typically? Yeah, so for consulting work, I go across the whole Midwest. And then awesome. I also do, and then land work, actually doing like food plots, water holes, timber stand improvement, all that. I stay in Wisconsin for that work.
Got it. Makes sense, dude. That's awesome. Well, dude, where do we begin with whitetails and water and all that? Like my brain wants to jump to setups and stuff like that, but I think let's like rewind. You mentioned deer using water and especially like in the summer months and everything, that being like a cheat code, dude. So like as a land manager in your experience, like how do you interpret deer using water? Like obviously it can be a funnel. It can be a destination. It can be like, you know, there's food around it. Like, where do we begin? What do you interpret
that as? I mean, to me, you know, so water, obviously, we're filling that void of three things wildlife all need is food, cover, and water. And most people haven't covered water because usually we think we have adequate water. Like, to me, like, I hunt around marshes and different things. I mean, I'm in some of the most wetland happy area in our state, but it's not quality water. So that's where my biologist expertise kind of came into it. Like I had to give quality water to them. And streams, creeks, marshes, that's not that. And it's not what deer prefer. So to me, what I started kind of doing is really diving in is, all right, what was the deer preference? What did they really want on the property per se to go to? And what it kind of comes down to is just some kind of, in a way, biology 101 of some of this stuff with whitetails, but They want warm water that's nutrient rich or mineral rich, I should say, not nutrient rich, mineral rich. And reason being is why they want it the same, closer to their body temperature is when every time they drink out of a creek, stream, or even marsh, that's usually a spring fed system, it's super cold. I mean, as you know, as being a trout guy, I mean, you go into these streams, it's frigid all year round, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when they drink cold water, it shocks their system. So it's when it's a game of survival and they drink this cold water and shocking their biological systems, that's not survival anymore. So they'd rather go drink out of warmer water sources that don't shock their system. And that's why over like in Europe, you won't see anything refrigerated, right? Drink wise, they know that shocks our system. It's not like we're the kind of people, humans as a culture, right? We want that ice cold beer at the end of the day or ice cold drink and not realizing, yeah, that shocks our system every time, but tastes great. But mm-hmm. with the deer, it's a game of survival. So they want that. They want warmer water. And that's why these ponds, tubs, you name it, they'll prefer. But then on the other side of it, when you have these natural ponds or line ponds, or you're putting in like some of these earth ponds, things that way in, what you're doing is actually allowing runoff to go into these and bringing in natural minerals. So deer are also, you know, just like any cattle or livestock would be out there, they're looking for that mineral that they're depleted in. So when you have mineral-enriched water, and that's when you hear the thing like, deer like muddy water. Well, it's not that they like crappy water. They like good water, but they want minerals in that water, you know, phosphorus, calcium, things like that, where they can help antler growth, health in general. So as I started putting these water systems in properties, what I found is I've actually been able to house deer closer to that water, especially in the summer and early fall. And even in the rut, it's become like I call it the cheat code, because it sounds crazy, but I've been able to pattern bucks to ponds in the rut. They're not eating during the rut. That's why they lose on average 28% of their body weight. They have to drink. It's just like if you or I were out in the Sahara Desert or the Gobi Desert, we can't go 3 days without water. We're dead. Same with the deer. Deer has to drink. And so I, just using that philosophy, I'm putting these in different areas of my properties and literally sucking bucks into it, especially during a rut when they're just chasing and need to drink. And I have one story of a buck that literally every single day of the rut, he came into a pond at 9:30, clockwork. And so one morning I kind of got the right wind and all that, went in knowing like, okay, it's going to be some time, brought a coffee out there. And here he came out of a 20 acre cattail marsh, walked up 75 yards to a line pond I have, maybe 100 yards to drink. And I shot that deer because he literally had to go get his drink of water after his morning, you know, doe run. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's just the when I started seeing that power of it and hearing people's success stories of like, holy crap, yeah, you're right. This pulled deer out of that creek system or that river or that marsh. And then they started shooting deer because of it. I started realizing how high of a priority that was versus sometimes even doing food plots. You know, food plot, there's food everywhere, but water, there's not good water everywhere.
Right. Dude, that's shocking about the creek system and like the shocking of their system and that cold water having that level of effect. Cause I think we always assume like, oh, it's hot. Like we want to go cool off and stand right in the water. Like a deer is probably going to want to do the same thing. And maybe they want to stand in it or they'll bed near it because it's right going to hold some cooler water or cooler air, I guess. But like the actual consumption of it shocking their system. Like I never would have thought of that. And it makes perfect sense. But also like, I love what you said there on the patterning of that buck to that water source and everything. And I'm sure we're going to dive into like what an ideal setup here looks like.
Right.
But
right,
that, I mean, I've kicked around the idea of like throwing in a little water hole or something on yep this little 5 acre piece that I grew up on specifically because it's red hot during the rut. And that's really the yep only time. But like, I love what you just said there about he does his morning circuit, checking all the bedding areas. And then he goes back to chill out for a little bit and yep hits that hole before he goes and lays down. Like that is awesome, dude. That's super freaking cool.
Even the amount of pictures I get, because I said most of my cell cams are up on ponds, I mean, most of the year. And just the amount of bucks I'll have come in, crash a pond and lay in it just to cool down. He's panting and he's just laying in there like, holy crap, all right, I got to go do round 47 a little bit here. But they'll crash in there, lay in them while they're panting, they're drinking, get back up, go time.
No kidding. So is there, I guess, like in terms of water holes, ponds, what have you, is there an ideal size? Obviously, it's going to be property dependent and, you know, where you're trying to put this thing. But yeah, like walk me through like the different sizes of water hole stuff.
Yeah, I mean, my preference, if you had that, you know, all right, I can do whatever I want, I have all the equipment, whatever it might be, I like to have a dug pond. That's me. I mean, anything usually from 20 to 30 foot diameter is my kind of golden size. Because if you get too big, it's no different than a huge field where the deer are kind of timid on it because they are so shown. Mm-hmm. So I found that 20 to 30 foot diameter pond, about 4 feet deep, that is perfect. But on the other side, I know a lot of guys don't have that time or the equipment, things that way. So what I usually tell people is do what you can with water, but never go less than 100 gallons. And there's a reason behind that. You know, so when you have under 100 gallons, and I'd say more is always better, but if you have under 100 gallons, you're going in there nonstop to fill it. So When you're hunting mature whitetails, intrusion is everything. If you're always in his bedroom and you're constantly bugging him, bumping him out because you have to fill your pond, well, that pond now hurts you because you just bumped him time after time. That's why I want more water out there. And also, too, you're just trying to, you're fighting evaporation. You're fighting them drinking it. You know, coons coming in, coyotes coming in, turkeys coming in, you name it. Everything's going to come to that water. Well, if you're not fighting that consumption and evaporation rate, you're just killing yourself on the back end because you're nonstop filling that pond. So that's why I say never go under 100. But when you do like a dug pond, line pond, like the size I was saying, you're getting like 1,500 to 2,500 gallons of water. You never have to go back to fill it. It's done. Right. I mean, all my ponds, I've never had to go and be like, oh, I better go add more to this pond. No, she's good to go.
Yeah. Not to mention something that size is pretty easy to shoot all the way around if you need
to. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into that. But yeah, to me, always place them within bull range. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I can't believe that they will prefer that stagnant. I guess it makes sense from the mineral enrichment standpoint. But I just can't believe that they're totally like, I don't want to say disregarding, but like a lot of it's disregarding moving water systems like creek bottoms and your river systems and stuff like that. Like, how do you, I guess, say you're somebody who's got a property like that, how do you try and complement that moving water with one of these stationary water sources?
Yeah, so to me, you know, a lot of it is I try to figure out where my deer are bedding. You know, so I want to get water close to that bedding if I can, because I don't want deer have to travel. If they're traveling, well, it's your neighbor has just as good a chance of killing them as you do.
For sure.
So I want to really hunker them in. So like I try to find those main benches, those ridges, those areas of certain exposures or winds where I can get water up tight close to them. Plus I'm looking for transitional ground. So bedding to food, food to food. And I want to get water there. So to me, once I get those in place, like you just said, like I hunted that 20 acre cattail marsh on my own property. Plus there's like three fishing ponds in the area. But I just make sure I try to quadrant my property. So like, let's say you have a 40, I'll try to quadrant that in four 10 acre parcels and I'll make sure, okay, each quadrant has water, and knowing that just the power in general of having that pond versus that stream, I'm going to pull the deer, but it's not there and they have to travel too far. They might just go and take that stream or that creek. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, that buck's zone, maybe he, you know, your northeast corner is the southwest corner of that buck's zone. I want to make sure he has water in his zone. Well, now I just sucked him tighter to that because he's like, all right, I got the food, I got water, I got cover near here. Why travel that quarter mile to the other water source? So to me, it's pretty simple to beat the creek or stream. It's just that your placement is going to be key in that.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Sure. How close are you trying to get to bedding on average? Obviously, it's a variable.
So it depends on time of year. Like, so I have water sources that I would say are my early season setups. So I'll go in and knowing full well these are more along my food plots, my bean plots, things that way that are on edges. So I don't want to go into my woods. I don't want to go into my bedding that time of year. But then I have ponds that are literally in it. I mean, right tight to bedding transitions where I know I'm only going to slip in there during the seeking phase or rut. And that's it. Maybe I only go in there 3 to 5 times total for a whole season. But I have those opportunities that I can move around based on my own scouting and knowing where my deer are at that time of year. So there's a lot of water sources out there, but knowing that I'm not going to hunt them all year, but I move with their movement. So like bedding, for instance, like, well, early season, they're really going on that food pretty heavy, especially when you get in early October, starting to go to a lot of greens. So I'm going to have those ponds more out near those green plots, things that way. Or like if you have oak stands, for instance, like I have some ponds that are near some big white oak stands, knowing those are my early season spots where I want to get in. I'm hunting acorns because that's their main food source that time of year, but I also have water nearby. So if they need a drink, they have both right there next to each other. But yeah, to answer your question, I mean, it depends on the time of year, but sometimes I'm in it. I'm in the bedding zone. Like one of those things that you feel like really risky, but it's high risk, high reward.
Totally. Yeah, no, makes sense, man. I'm curious here, just because I'm still in a little bit of like public land brain right now. So say you've got, I'm picturing this one property, there's got this larger river system, but there's also a handful of kind of marshy, more stag, it's not really marshy, but it's like basically in the floodplain kind of created this low spot that still holds water. Will that still create much of a draw for whitetails, or is it more so they're still looking for those? Because there's also up the hill a piece of private that I can very clearly see a nice pond on. So
right. Yeah, no, it's public instances, like kind of what I scout for, like on the public side of it, is areas that it pools up, or there might be an eddy that comes off, or a little drainage zone, things that way. But I'm trying to find where water can, in a way, stagnate itself. It's just constantly flowing, but you find those, or the, in northern Wisconsin, we get a lot, they're called ephemeral pools. So it's a false pond that only fills up during rain events. Well, if you know you have one of those that fills up more often than not, I'm getting near those spots. You know, so to me, it's more find those spots that are more stagnant. Now, if it's a rapid stream system, well, then I'm hunting the crossings that go over and things that way and trying to find their main travel routes, knowing that they're probably not really stopping to drink there. But ultimately, to me, find those stagnant pools on that public, you know, especially early in the year when you want to do some really good damage on, let's say, getting some does or trying to get that early season buck that's not super pressured yet, try to find those little pooled up areas of water.
Okay, got it. And so you kind of answered one of my questions there on the moving water front. Like if you do have a creek or a river system, you're primarily viewing that as like, where can I find those pinch points, those crossings and those areas that are going to funnel deer movement, whether it's pushing them up against a bluff or so on and so forth there.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, water is the best way to predict deer movement, because when you got streams and rivers, A, you're going to get a lot more deer during the rut because they're just chasing them as travel corridors. They don't even know where they're really going. They're just running that river system. But to me, you'll find those spots. And I see this more like in Iowa and Missouri, where they get these big washout creeks and things where there might be a 20-foot drop-off. Well, so you'll find that little spot where it dips down and that major deer trail is going there across that stream system. So that's where you could predict, like kind of like in a way cattle, like, yeah, they're going to cross here. This is where they cross. Yeah, not saying they won't go 100 yards upstream and just try to do a death jump and jump over it, but you can find those pinch points. It's pretty simple to get on their pattern that way.
For sure. Yeah. No, that's what I've found as well. Although I did have one doe with a couple of yearlings. They did stand, granted it was like 92 degrees, but they did stand in one of these kind of slow glides, and I could hear them like 30 yards below me, like... slurping up water. I'm like, huh. So they do drink out of trout streams, but that's the only time I've ever heard it. So hearing you debunk that, definitely, because that's like you, I feel like you've heard so much stuff over the past, you know, couple of years now. Everybody's got a podcast, everybody's putting out content, and everybody's like, no, they only want the stagnant, muddy water, like he said. And I was like, maybe I'm just being contrarian here and I'm like looking for like, well, I've got a trout stream. How can I work with that? And
Right. But, and then that's the thing. If it's the only thing there, that's the only water they have. They're going to drink out of it.
When you
start getting better water out there, they're going to start preferring that. But when you have only that, or maybe you're hunting like, you know, in Wisconsin, we have the Horicon Marsh and El Dorado Marsh with these big marsh systems. There's not much for ponds in that property, but so you'll get a little duck hole or whatever it might be where they can feel safe drinking, have that escape route and all that. Yeah, those are still good areas to key in on. It's just a matter, you got to know, are there water sources? If not, then it's not an issue to hunt those streams and creek systems.
Sure. And so on the marsh front, like the reason they don't necessarily want to drink that water is primarily because it's all filtered out, or it's just, is it?
Like... No, so a lot of it is when you, the marsh, you can look at it as being our liver, right? So a liver takes out all the toxins. Yep. So when a marsh system is near agriculture ground, especially, it's collecting all the herbicides, all the fertilizers, all that. It's actually not good water in general. It's actually very polluted water typically. Not that a marsh isn't filtering like crazy, but it's not that preferred, nice, clean water that they really want to have. Still mineral enriched, but animals are way smarter than we are, where they can still tell if it's polluted or not. So to me, like I have one client, for instance, he hunts near one of the bigger marshes in our state, and outside of like the floodplain of it, we put ponds just so we could get him in. At first he looked at me, he's like, you're on something. Why would we put ponds when I have a giant marsh here, public land marsh? Mm-hmm. I'm like, just work with me. And we put two ponds in, and then he started shooting bucks. He's like, I never thought this would work. But then we started pulling them right out of the cattail marsh right to those ponds.
No kidding, dude. So that's like a super important distinction to make, that like just because there's water somewhere, not all water is created equal. And even though, absolutely, like we say, you hear that deer like muddy water or whatever it may be, and our favorite duck hole or marsh or whatever is obviously muddy and nasty and full of crap, like that, at least the top layer of it is full of all the nastiest stuff that's out there. And
right, so, right. And like, and my, so like my sister, she's a nutritional veterinarian, so I bump a lot of this stuff off her and talk to her about it. But like, we talk about even in the livestock world, and when you think about it, well, there's a reason why you had to go and change water. You know, some of animals are like, okay, this is polluted, this is has pathogens, whatever. They know that. They know they got sick from it. Some of them are like, I'm not drinking that. I'd rather just not drink. And so then you have to go and give them fresh water. So that's one of those things. It's kind of bringing that nutritional side of it into it and going, okay, yeah, we have to give them these sources.
For sure. Gosh, that's fascinating, man. Because I want to keep pushing back and being like, well, we're talking about like clear, mineral rich, like good water. Like, wouldn't it be a trout stream? But no, because there's not enough minerals in it.
And I will say, like, a true trout stream, you know, when you have brooks and browns and all these things in it, that is good water. So it is good, clean water. It's just, for most part, when it comes to the trout stream versus some of these rivers and streams out there, is you actually have very good purified water, because trout are, as you know, are very susceptible to pollution or nutrient issues and all these different things. That'll be the reason why in Wisconsin we lost over 50% of our brook trout habitat. And a lot of that is pollution and agriculture use and all these things. So those are really good, healthy water sources. A lot of it is just going back to more of that cold factor for them. So they'll drink it knowing it's better water. They just don't care for the cold versus the warmer water.
Got it. Makes sense. Yeah, in a pinch, when they have to, they'll do it. Aside from that, if they can do it in the ice.
Right.
Let me ask you this, and then I'll finally move on from the moving water thing, I promise. But so you've got like crossings and stuff. Like, say they are going to come in and eat, because I was talking with another guy, Tony Van Asten, on the show a couple weeks ago, and we were both kicking around because we hunt the Driftless region where there's all sorts of these, you know, streams, springheads, drainages, coulees, all that good stuff. And finding like the one spot where like a deer will actually hang out a little bit is like just the thickest, nastiest, most covered up hellhole on the creek. And that's where they'll touch it. But aside from that, because like they're still, like you, to your point, you know, about bedding and everything, they still want that cover and to be secluded and protected and everything. Right. Is that generally how you're seeing mature bucks using those creek systems outside of the rut when they're just using it like a highway?
So a lot of that goes into like, so, and this is, I guess, my point when you talk about people have like acre ponds, half acre ponds or bigger, right? And they're like, well, why don't these deer drink out of that pond? Because it's super open. They can see, they can see everything, but they also know every predator in that zone can also see them, right? So to me, that's why like when I put water out or have water or find water, it's always in those spots where transitional zones where they can kind of sit back, they feel safe, they have escape routes, but they know predators can't see them drink. Because one thing, at least my thinking on it, is deer are most vulnerable when they drink because they are stuck drinking in the spot. Whereas feeding, they're moving. Even in cover, they're constantly picking up, rebedding. So in water, they're stuck there. They're drinking. So to me, that's their most vulnerable thing they'll do, action they'll do in their life. And that's why they'll have that cover, and mainly, most importantly, side cover, you know, horizontal cover versus vertical cover.
Definitely. Yeah, that makes sense there. I'm sitting here picturing a million different ponds right now as we're talking about this, dude. Like my wheels are, like when I said I had a lot of questions piled up in my brain, I meant it, dude, because I'm sitting picturing like this this farm pond that's kind of got like a dike on one side of it. And it's just, I mean, the dike itself is probably 15, 20 feet wide, but it's super thick and there's always one banging scrape on it, like halfway around the backside of the pond. I'm like, if I were to shoot, like I could set up, but I'm literally going to be like an arm's length away from that deer while working that scrape. So it just isn't going to work, but maybe I can figure something out and all that. But to that point though, that is also the most secluded spot on the on the property there.
Well, and in those instances too, to me, some of the best hunting you can do is in transition, right? So like, if you know there's a water source and you know where they're bedding to go to that water source, I'd rather, in a way, sometimes not hunt over that water source and be in between, because their focus is, I'm going to go to that area to drink. Well, if you can catch them going to that, their mind's not up on you up in that tree, so you can get that shot. Whereas when they're drinking or feeding, as you know, they're on their tippy toes. Yeah. You know, one false movement or something, you're like, drop your cell phone or whatever it might be, and they're gone, right? It's because they're vulnerable. They're waiting for something to spook them. Whereas if they're in transition, they're not in that mode yet.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned high stem count and like, you know, horizontal cover around these ponds, around these water sources. Like, my brain jumps to willow thickets and, you know, nasty stuff like that. When it comes to kind of, I guess, brushing in your pond or your water source, what do you tend to look for?
Yeah, so a lot of times, like, my water sources, what I want to keep them fairly open because they're smaller, so they feel safe in the first place. You know, but with that said, like, what I'll do is, like, when I clear a spot, for instance, I'm putting the brush on the sides. The biggest thing you got to avoid, though, is if a deer feels like he's caged in or he's fenced in, it's not going to like that either, because he feels like, I can't escape. So I usually keep a buffer zone around those ponds that's open. You know, so like, even like one I have, for instance, there's some dogwood that's on one side, but I'm probably on from the edge of my pond, I'm probably 15 feet only from that buffer, but they can at least freely walk around that pond, drink where they please, but be close enough to that cover they can bounce back into.
For sure. Yeah. Well, they always got to have that escape route. That was like one thing, right? As I was scouting on some of those points, I was like, if it's totally, and that was then kind of how I figured out that that buck bed that I was talking about in the intro. It was like, okay, he's got three different routes out of here, and I thought he only had the one. So now this just confirms that theory even more, that like, no matter which way I come from, he's got an escape route, so he's probably going to use that. Whereas some of those other points, there's just nothing there because it's all cliffed out. But
right, and the same goes for bedding, right? If they don't have an escape route, they're not using that bedding area. You know, so that's why when I go to thickets on private properties, I got to clear them out. I got to make lanes. I got to, you know, maybe there's a bunch of dead ash that fell through. I got to cut those lanes back open. They don't feel like they can escape it, they ain't using it. I mean, that's why, like, you know, you get a topic, and this is a different topic in the water, but like hinge cutting, some guys will go in there and think it's a great idea, and they make what I call tornado zones. And now only a rabbit uses it because that's the only thing that feels safe in it. Yep. You know, so the same concept applies for everything. And that's why, like, when I put water, a lot of times, even like, let's say it's a field edge, I'll put in that corner where the deer enters the field. I want that water right in that corner because that's where he's going to come. While the does, the six pointers, the spikes, they're all feeding ready. He can sit back, he can drink, he can kind of analyze that field, wait till dusk, and then he can enter the big field. Well, you as a hunter already over top of that pond in transition, and you're getting a shot on him. He thinks he's safe back kind of with some brush and some in the water, and maybe you have some clover or something around it, but now he's sitting back there, not alarmed, because he's able to view the big open zone before he enters it.
For sure. Yeah. And I'm assuming that's, I mean, if you're putting in a pond anywhere, it's got to be a low spot, right? Which luckily most bucks are already accessing a field generally in those kind of low corners of those low draws and stuff where they've got that thermal pooling. But
yeah, and there, and the other thing I really love is actually high and dry. Like when you go to bluff country, for instance, I love getting on top of a ridge and putting water because there is no water.
Right.
Why? And to me, a lazy deer is a big deer. So if you want to make him stay in his zone, put water where he is. So I keep water high, low. I mean, I decorate it like a Christmas tree. And end of the day, though, if you can get high and dry and low, you just won the battle of the thermal game, because now you can hunt in those mornings when the thermals are rising. He wants to be up on that ridge anyways to scent does, and you provided him the water. Rather than him having sent it and be like, all right, I'm thirsty, now I have to go back down the ridge, which is not ideal, to get my water. So to me, I'm putting them high and dry and low.
For sure. I love that approach, dude. That's, yeah, that, yeah, I mean, kind of circles back. My brain jumps to a Tony Peterson quote of like, hunt what's limited. And if you can create what's limited there, then that's all the better, man. That's kind of a perfect segue, dude. Walk me through like some of your favorite setups that you've created, and how people might, like, say we've got a ridge top set up, maybe an ag field set up, and then something down near the bottom towards, you know, a lower system, or even like flatland type stuff. Like, what are some of your favorites, favorite kind of scenarios to lay successful water holes in.
Yeah. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, I guess my favorite setups. So for one, you know, I always talk about transitions, but I've had really good success when I can do a bedding to food or bedding to bedding. And those are some of my favorites. And reason being is, so early season, bedding to food is very important. So if I can get my deer traveling and I know they're coming off, let's say a ridge top, they're going down low to feed in, let's say a food plot or a thicket or whatever it might be, and I have water there, well, now I know they're going to drink there and I can hunt it early. I don't have to hunt it during the rut. But then during the rut, since I know bucks, and this is just fact, is they're going bedding to bedding all day long. They're constantly moving. It's not like they're laying on me like, I guess I'll run again at 3 p.m. No, they're chasing. And if I can get water, and I talk about those legacy trails, if I can figure out where two or three of those legacy trails meet up and intersect, I'm putting water there. Because now I just took all those trails and I put it to what I call a social interaction point. And I'm hunting pretty much that water and those travels. So to me, it just made that spot hotter because now every doe is going there, every buck's going there, and I can literally just sit this little tiny, you know, pond or tank or tub, whatever it might be, and just wait and see. And those are really, really hot when it comes to the seeking phase, like October 20th and on. I love that spot. The other thing I do is, you know, you guys want to put in these giant food plots, and it's just fine to get forage out there. But what I love is I make micro plots, whether it be in the woods or on the edges, that are maybe only 10 to 12 acre in size. And I'll put a water hole right in the middle of that thing. So whether deer are entering to go to, let's say, an acre bean field, but you just put in this little 10th acre clover plot with a pond inside, that's what I love. I love hunting. That's what that one buck that I talked about where I pulled him out of the marsh, that was on a little tiny micro plot in between egg and the marsh. And he came in, didn't even care about the clover, right to that water. And got, because he was about to go to the big field to look for does. And that was his routine. So to me, look for those transitions. I mean, even food to food, if you have, let's say, a pinch point of timber and, you know, a different type of habitat meat, but they're going from one food source to this other field, but you pinch them down somewhere and you put water there, well, now both those fields are interacting with that same social interaction point of water. So I'd say those are some of my most ideal setups per se. But I really love the one inside woods, inside timber, ridge tops, things like where I know they're chasing and I can really key in on those intersecting trails.
For sure. Yeah, makes sense, dude. One of the things, this isn't water related, but one of the things you mentioned was like putting in food sources or little micro plots inside the timber. You mentioned clover. Is there any other good, I guess, food source to put in the timber? It's maybe a better shade tolerant thing.
Yeah. So inner timber is tough. Usually a lot of guys are doing, they're doing clovers, chicories, things of that nature. There's some blends that I've put out, there's one blend in particular, it's called Rackfield Showtime. It's actually chicory, plantain, small burnet, and alfalfa. And I plant that in a lot of my logging roads, my little micro plots. I've had tremendous success with that, where it literally just grows all year round. All I have to do is frost eat it. But to me, like those are spots, even northern woods, right? When you get northern Wisconsin, that's big timber property. And I'll put in these little tiny food plots with stuff like that, with more of those residuals, because you never want to do annual species because that won't grow, like your radishes, your turnips, things that way. They're just, you'll see them just trying to get sunlight and they're trying to grow upwards and they're just going to die. So that's where you have to get more like white clovers. A lot of times are more shade tolerant than your reds. And so like a lot of guys will use like Ladino clover is pretty popular. But overall, I mean, it's one of those things that if you get it, just make sure you plant it at the right time of year. You want to plant it pretty much in the springtime before the canopy goes on. And that'll help protect that food plot. Because once they're grown, they're getting a little bit of shade and sun here and there. But at least if they're established already, it's harder for them to go to the wayside.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, dude, especially right now as we're kind of in that late February, early March time frame. You know, obviously there's the ground starting to thaw out in certain spots here. And I know guys' brains are starting to smoke a little bit in terms of what am I going to throw out here and how am I going to make this better and all that sort of stuff. Like, walk me through a little bit of the schedule for this spring, kind of from this first week of March time frame forward in terms of like what the best time frame is or the best order is to do some of these projects.
Yeah. So like right now, I mean, to me, get out there for one, obviously deer are dropping their antlers. So get out there and scout, find bedding zones, find your trails, mark those, figure out what you're going to do is essentially for maybe even some stand setup work. But like right now I'm getting heavy on like timber stand improvement stuff. So like I'm going and doing stump cutting, or I'm maybe doing hack and squirt, or I'm doing hinge cutting, whatever it might be doing, but a lot of timber stand stuff. And you want to do that realistically before. One guy always told me, especially with hinge cutting, is you want to do it before the leaves are no bigger than like a mouse's ear. But after that, you're done. So really these next couple months are pretty key ones for that. But also like when we get those warm-ups, you know, that we're having, like we just had that giant one last week, 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. That was a perfect frost seeding time. So going out there and actually frost seeding food plots with your clover, chicory, perennial blends, frost seeding is amazing. So that's something I'm getting done briskly February, March, April is when I'm doing, depending where I'm at in the state.
It's most of that kind of throw and go type stuff.
Like, I know. So it's, what's really neat about it is you can do pretty much any clover blend that's out there, and you can frost seed that. So the only thing, the only really caveat to it is you just got to have bare soil. So whether it was a old food plot, or maybe it's a spot in the woods that you took a leaf blower to and you just cleared the ground, you can frost seed that. Now I prefer if you can do some weed control to get that under control, that'll help your food plot look better and be more productive. But you just need to have that soil contact, because it's neat with frosty. And what's happening is as the ground thaws, it's opening up and these cracks will open up, the seeds will fall in. And then during the frost at night, it contracts and brings that seed into the ground. So you never have to work the ground. So if you don't have that four-wheeler, you don't have this, don't worry about it. You're just more on that side of the frost seeding.
Got it. You mentioned the cut and squirt stuff too as well before sorry, I don't mean to keep cutting you off. In terms of like your I'm picturing like honeysuckle, getting that crap there, getting your multi-floor rows, all that sort of stuff.
Well, that, and even like, let's say non-valuable trees. So like basswood or ironwood and these other species that might be competing for shade that you can get rid of. But yeah, I mean, this is a time where like, you go out there and there's different herbicides out there, but you want to go and essentially take a hatchet, you hack into it, you spray it with herbicide and you keep walking. But yeah, you can do it to your invasives. I mean, to me, a lot of times I do more stump cutting. So I'll completely cut it and then I'll spray the top of that stump so it gets all the herbicide in it.
Sure.
But when you're doing trees that you just don't want there, but you don't want to cut them down, that's per se, then you can just do the hack and squirt. I mean, I know of guys that do it on maples. They'll do it on hickories. They'll just because they're trying to get rid of that canopy in the zone. Or maybe a guy doesn't have the equipment to make that food plot. Like I have a friend up in Rusk County, or actually further north than that, and he went and he went girdled and heck and squirted a bunch of trees because he needed sunlight for his food plot he wanted to put in.
Got it. That's interesting. I haven't heard of folks doing that. I'm very, very green to the habitat side of things, but I haven't heard of folks doing the hack or just to leave that tree bare so that it doesn't. That makes,
Especially if you don't have a chainsaw and you're like, oh, I can't afford a chainsaw. Well, you probably can afford a hatchet and a little sprayer. Well, you can just do that just to at least get that canopy open. And whenever you get time or you get a buddy with a chainsaw, you can always cut those trees down later. But to me, at least get that canopy opened up so you can get that sunlight. Because the rule of thumb for a food plot, and I was taught this by a forester years ago, was you want a 70 by 70 foot opening in the canopy. And that's not looking, you know, linearly and looking, okay, that's a tree 70 feet from that tree. You got to look up and literally see that there's a sunlight gap of 70 feet by 70 feet roughly. That'll provide you enough sunlight for actual growth. So that's probably the biggest thing. But yeah, I mean, I'll do it a lot of times with, like you said, more of those trees that I'm like, all right, I just want to have it dead because I need sunlight, or maybe it's an invasive, but the hack and squirt method or girdling, even with a chainsaw, works really well.
Got it. Deal. I cut you off there, but then, so beyond that, then I'm assuming that we get.
Yeah, so realistically, I mean, and like right now, this time of year, you got to start ordering things, so like tree orders and all that kind of stuff. So like I'm actually getting all my orders in for my clients. So getting fruit trees ordered, nut trees ordered, doing pine trees or oaks, whatever it might be, whatever the project entails. But I'm getting that order in so that way in April, I'm starting to plant trees. So really, that's right out of the gate as well. So really, to me, habitat management is super spring heavy, super spring heavy. And because the food plot side of it, like in the summer, to me is not, that's not the labor intensive side of it. I mean, you can usually knock out plots in a weekend. But doing timber stand stuff, or, you know, even getting loggers on property, all that kind of stuff. That's a springtime event. But even the trees orders, like I have a lot of guys who'll drag their feet. And then in May, they're like, well, I'd like to get some trees. Well, now you have to wait till fall to order your trees. you're way behind eight ball. And what they always say, the best tree is the one you planted 10 years ago. So you want to get your orders in. But then once we get, you know, the trees in, and I also, I do a lot of screening. I don't know if you ever heard of a plant species, it's called Miscanthus. So it's it looks like Phragmites in our state, the invasive species. Okay. It looks almost identical to that, but it's sterile. So like I use that for screening, but that's usually like April, May planting. So like I said, it's a lot of work front on, and then you have a big gap. Like, so for me, like when I get past April, May, my big planting, you know, whether it be screening or I'm doing trees or whatever it might be, June then is kind of the month I usually pick for water. So that's, everything's kind of dried down. We don't have the spring rains anymore. You can usually get in with equipment. So June, I do a lot of pond work and tubs and things that way. And it's kind of the dead time of the summer, because you're kind of like, well, all right, well, the planting's done for spring. I don't food plot till July or August. What the hell am I going to do? And to me, I can't sit still. So that's when I do my water. And then lead into July, then we get ramped back up into a fall planting.
Sure. Got it. Talk me through the do's and don'ts when it comes to setting up a good water hole.
Yeah. So to me, it, you know, for one, placement is going to be your key, right? I mean, you can put water wherever, but once again, let the deer tell you where they want to be. Mm-hmm. So set up that water hole. So it's a spot where deer have access around it. And I'll kind of give a reasoning, an example of that is I went out on a property last year that a gentleman just bought, and the previous owner had a bunch of water holes, or I should say this kind of like totes. Like, yeah, I think they were like maybe 20 gallon totes. They were tiny, but he had them butted up right next to a pine tree. Well, a deer's not going to go and stick its head in there like a bear, bear bait, and be like, I'm going to drink out of this. No, you got to have space where they can get around that whole water body. So to me, you know, that's one, is make sure there's enough space around that pond where they can actually go around, they can view and see what's happening around that water source, so they feel comfortable and not caged in. Another one is going too small. Don't think just because, you know, the guy down the road gave you a 55-gallon drum that I'm going to cut this in half and that's my water source. No, actually do some research. Find, I mean, you can get some pretty cheap containers, like even like the big Rubbermaids, like I think they're 150 gallons. You can get them for a pretty decent price. And so don't skimp on size of water just to think you're going to get water. It's not going to work that way. I mean, for one, now you have evaporation issues. You have the consumption issues I talked about. So I'd say going too small is definitely a don't. Go bigger if you can, but not too big. Like I said, the hot, to me, that sweet spot is that 20 to 30 foot diameter pond. That, if you can, ideal. Another one is kind of just thinking that because you put water, you don't have to maintain it. That's another one. So, like, and this is me being the biologist and pond manager I was, but I've seen so many ponds where people throw them out there and they'll never touch them again. They're like, did my job. I dug a hole and I have a water. Not realizing that all that leaf litter, all the a coon going in there crapping it, all these things. And suddenly now you have this little cesspool that the deer don't drink anyways. So if you have more of the tub side of things, is take your time and clean them out probably once every 2 years. And just, I mean, literally pull that whole thing out, drain it, pressure wash it, get it clean again. Because like I did, went down to actually Todd Graff, who has bowhunting.com, bowhunter die.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And Todd, we went down there and we were talking about one of his ponds. He's like, you know, the first year was awesome. Deer were in here, they were using it. And every single year it got less and less and less. I'm like, yeah, because the water quality is going to crap. That's why they could tell. They're like, I don't like this anymore. This is bad water. So they left it. So if you have a pond, there's ways to actually take care of it. So like I actually invented a product this last year, cause I've been working on the EHD issue that's hitting the Midwest. So I invented a product called EHD Fence, but it's actually a product to maintain your ponds and your tubs. So it's literally packets and different things you can put in there just to keep that water healthy and clean and clear. So maintaining is a big one. Like make sure you have that part of your plan, just like you would your food plots or your timber, whatever it might be, you have to maintain water. So don't just think cause you put it in there, it's done. You have to still manage it.
Sure. Dude, that's badass. that was one of my questions here was like, gosh, like everybody's freaking out about the EHD thing. But that's freaking cool, dude.
Yep. That's my brainchild from like the last decade. It's finally just brought it to life.
We need to work on maybe some CW defense now. And
let's yeah, see that's, if we can. There's definitely more money from the government on that side, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
But no, yes, yeah, so, I mean, it's a simple process, but it really helps keep these water. And even the guys that I've worked with that have been maintaining water now, realizing it's important, they're kind of impressed on the side that they're like, just my deer usage went up just by taking care of it and adding bacteria and enzymes and things to the water. So like, yeah, just my deer use it way more. I'm like, it's because you're making quality water. So different than like we talked about changing the water for livestock. You are giving them that clean, clear water that they desire. The other, I'd say another big don't is when you're food plotting next to water, and I've seen guys do this a lot, is they want that food plot to look great, right? They want add as much fertilizer and all these different things to it. And I can tell you, and this is from my work dealing with more stormwater ponds and subdivisions, the greenest lawns in the area had the greenest ponds because all that ran into that pond. So when you're food plotting, try to, if you can, whether it's a tub or an actual pond, make a good buffer of, let's say, clover and chicory or maybe prairie grass, whatever it might be, but give a buffer between that pond and your actual food plot that you're fertilizing, just so it can take that nutrients away so it doesn't pollute and damage your pond. So I'd say that's another one. But the other thing is making sure that you have those ponds, honestly. And it sounds probably like, well, of course, but get those ponds in shooting distance because it is crazy the amount of success you're going to have when you have that water within 20, 30 yards and just sightings. I mean, I literally sit in some of my rut stands and it's awesome just watching, oh, and here comes a new buck. He drank. All right, here comes a new buck. Okay, that nubbin just ate crap in the pond because he's running around like an idiot. I mean, it's fun just watching that interaction. And even on the turkey hunting side, like you can hunt turkeys over ponds, which is also something that people don't realize. And I did a podcast on it this morning. Like literally I can sit behind a pond, the hens will come to it, and the tom will come right in, and I only have to call because they just wanted to drink water. But definitely get your stands near them because it's powerful. And don't think that just because you don't have low ground, you can't have water. That's another one. Guys are like, well, I don't have a wet spot. That's all right. There's different tubs, and like the earth ponds are really cool. I really like their design with the slope and everything. But there's a lot of ways that you can get water on that property.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of like the ponds and like the different liners and tubs and stuff like that, what do you recommend there? You said like 100-gallon minimum, but beyond that, like just your standard, you know, feed tub, that kind of thing, or water trough type thing, or is there a shape you prefer?
Yeah, so like the earth ponds I really like is because they have that slope. So like they have a basin, but then they go up so deer can get into them. That's what I really like. If you start getting on the tub side, so like you have the Rubbermaid ones out there, or sometimes you see those galvanized like cow troughs that are out there, they work. But I'd say sometimes with those ones, you're better off actually lifting them out of the ground so they're a little higher for the deer to drink because they can't step into it. So they can't get low enough. So it's a little kind of a pain from the drink out of those. So if you can actually raise them up where now it's a little more easy for them to drink, I would definitely do that. But there's a bunch of different sizes, like usually like 150 gallon for whatever reason is pretty common out there for these troughs. But like I know earth pond is, I think their biggest one's like 240 or 250 gallons. And it's easy enough where you can dig it in with a shovel. And so I use those quite a bit. I've had some guys do, like I said, the 55 gallon drums, don't do that. I have some guys do like those big white totes. Like you see the ones with the big chemical totes out there. Mm-hmm. They're like 275 gallons. I've seen guys cut those in half. But once again, just realize that you probably should raise it out of the ground a little bit so the deer can drink easier. And then it's kind of making fun of it, but you know, you'll see like the Jeff Sturgis videos where he's like, you gotta put a stick in it. And it's true. So I call it the Sturgis stick because he kind of made it, but it makes sense because when you have these square sided tanks, squirrels and all these things can fall into and they can't get out and they'll die. Mm-hmm. Well, now you just have this gross dead cesspool pathogen bacteria. Ugh. And deer aren't drinking out either. So you definitely got to put something in for animals to get out. Koi ponds is another one. I've seen guys use koi ponds before that you'll get on Home Depot, Lowe's or something like that. Those work. But then also like if you're doing the ponds, there's different good pond liners out there. And that's something like if anyone's ever thinking of doing that, I'd strongly recommend reaching out to me because there's good ones and bad ones out there. Like don't use just a random billboard tarp because there might be actually different coatings on there that can actually hurt the environment. So I'd rather use these true pond liners that I used to use when I was building ponds. to do those, because there's some that have like UV coating, so then they can't get damaged, and there's different ways to build them so like the hooves and stuff like that don't damage a liner. So there's definitely a little more strategy to that when you're putting on a line pod.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense. In terms of those smaller water holes and stuff that are obviously going to be a little bit more, you know, say budget friendly, I guess, for lack of a better term, where someone's like, I'm on a budget, I want to slap one of these things into my property here. Digging that thing in so that it's still got a little bit of overhang above the ground and everything. Yep. Are you still relying? I'm assuming then you're fully reliant on going back in to refill that manually.
100%.
That's the only downside.
Yep. And that's the thing. Like, so that's why if you can try to get something that you can get flush on the ground to take advantage of runoff.
Sure.
You know, because it's one of those things, if you can't take advantage, you absolutely have to do it. And now you're dealing with intrusion. So that's a big risk of, if especially where you put them. Like if you put one and it's in a bedding, and you're going in there, your odds every time you went and fill it are decreasing every single time. So
for sure,
if you can use runoff, you can get a level. And that's why I usually, like I said, I kind of side more with that earth pond design, just because it has that slope and you can use runoff, a deer can use it actively. I usually like doing that method. Now, I will say, like, I don't put really any of my ponds up just because I do want to benefit on runoff. I don't want to go bugger my deer. Yeah, I might have reduction on drinking, but I'd rather not go in and intrude on them then fill it. So it's kind of one of those things, you got to weigh out what you want to do. If you know you're not going to be at a property a lot, say you only can get to your property once, twice a year, now you're going to have to use runoff because you can't go fill it. You know, so to me, those are instances you have to go ground level with it.
Sure. When it comes to refilling your pond and minimizing intrusion, is there a time that you want to shoot for to do that? Like, obviously make sure everything's topped off going into the fall and everything.
Yep.
But say you're something went horribly wrong, it's October 15th or something like that, and something weird happened, and oh shoot, that pond's not as full as I thought it was, darn. What's the best move to get in there? Is it using equipment to kind of mask your scent, or
it's whatever you use commonly, right? Like if you're always going up there with a four-wheeler, use that four-wheeler. Sure. So like the company, like the Banks Blinds, for instance, they make, I think it's called like the water bladder or something. I forget what it's called, but like they have this big bladder. It's a 100-gallon bladder you can put on the back of a trailer or on the back of a UTV. But whatever you're most commonly going in there with, use that. Like even if it's a tractor, bring the tractor up with forks and a tote. Like for me, like I do a lot of work with a skid loader. So like I'll go up in my skid loader and that's what I fill with. And I leave it run the whole time. So like I don't shut it off and I'm walking around talking and, you know, playing. No, I literally let it run, I let it fill, and I get the heck out. So that way the deer are kind of looking at it like it's just machinery, especially in ag country. They're used to hearing equipment. So that doesn't bug them as much as like you going in there with 5-gallon buckets and you're dumping and thinking you're thinking you're
cussing
doing
up
right.
The storm falling on your face and sloshing around. Yeah.
Right. So whatever method you go up there, even if it's an e-bike, I mean, you have to take little gallons with an e-bike, but that's how you go into your property to do that. And just make sure you're not shooting those key times when they're moving, right? Try to go midday and things that way.
Yep.
But also, like I'll say it, and this is what's crazy about water, is some people are like so worried about getting in early enough and then keeping it filled all summer long. Well, like I have one example. Like I had a client, he really wanted a pond back in the timber. And I'm like, all right, you know, that's fine. But it was like 2 weeks before opener here in Wisconsin. So I was like, okay, we're going to get in it.
Got so close, yeah.
I went in there with mini excavator. I literally dug this whole pond, lined it, did everything. Equipment was running the whole time. And 2 weeks later, so that pond just from rainwater started filling up. 2 weeks later, he shot, I think it was like 130-inch 8-pointer. Came to that water. They smelled it and he was already in it. But he didn't care that I was in there for that one day to get it done. So those are instances too. Like, let's say if you know you don't go to a property to hunt till the rut, but you know your deer are there anyways, maybe don't even fill that water for the first time till 2-3 weeks before you know you're going to hunt. You know, now that water's there, you didn't do any intrusion beforehand. Yeah, are you getting all the benefit of all summer long and early fall of them drinking? No, but now it's there. So they're already there in that location, but now you added water. It's kind of like us when you see something new, you're like, ooh, all right, piece of candy. And so they're on top of it. So don't think like, all right, I have to keep this maintained or filled. Sometimes it's just get it filled before. Like even I know a guy in Kentucky last year, he had a really big 8-pointer. He shot it, I think it went like 166 or 167, giant 8-pointer. And he didn't get that water in until I think it was like a week or two before his season. And then he went and killed that deer that was going in that water nonstop.
Dude, that is an absolutely disgusting 8-pointer.
Oh, it's
big. Oh my god.
When he sent me the picture, I'm like, oh my.
Holy smokes, dude.
I thought I was doing good with like 140-inch 8-pointer, and then he does that. I'm like, oh, okay. They get way bigger. Cool.
Yeah, that's what they're supposed to look like, huh? Shoot. Right. That's awesome, dude. Well, man, did we forget anything? Like, what have we not covered on the waterfront here? Anything that's still rattling around?
Nothing on top of my head right now.
No? Okay. Awesome.
Covered a pretty decent amount of it.
Yeah, definitely, dude. Dude, I've learned a ton here so far, chatting with you and just about how deer use water in particular. Like I've learned a ton through this that filled in a lot of gaps that I didn't even know were there in my whitetail approach there. And I've got the wheels turning on some private pieces for the upcoming year, I think. But
yeah,
go ahead.
And as I say too, and there again, if you guys are hunting public, you know, like I know years ago, even like the Hunting Public and Hunting Beast, they did some videos on it, but look for those pockets of water. Totally. I mean, to me, that's another thing that so many guys overlook because they're like, oh, it's just a little pond there. That's not doing anything. I got to find the acorns but don't overlook those ponds. Throw some cameras up on them because to me, that could be that hidden gem that you overlooked all these years on public where you can't modify, you can't manipulate. And to me, keep that in the back of your mind when you're out scouting, especially this spring.
Yeah, definitely. That's there's a couple of pieces that I've ran across where you can tell it was back in the day it was private, or maybe it was just it's always been public, but it was somebody who didn't want to follow the rules. And oh, weird, there's a peculiar low spot where it looks like a couple years worth of mineral blocks have worn their way through the soil up there, but son of a gun, that fills in pretty good, doesn't it?
Right.
Huh, interesting.
Right.
And yeah, it's yeah, you can definitely find those things on, especially a lot of that. Like there's so much, I mean, every time I go into Onyx, I feel like I just found some other piece or like, huh, I didn't know that was public. That's pretty freaking cool. Well,
and I guess one other thing too, I'll point out kind of before we wrap out too, is like, especially important for the public land side of it, but also look for, there's certain aquatic plants to look for around these ponds too. So
dude, yeah,
if you find, so one's called arrowhead. So it literally looks like a giant arrow. Right. And so we call that the aquatic food plot because deer crush it. I mean, they absolutely love it. So if you find arrowhead growing around a little pond system, no, that's a forage source for deer. Also iris. So like you'll see blue flag iris in places too. Like right now my deer are going around, I have an acre fishing pond on my property and my deer are literally leaving my timber, coming down to that big pond and they're eating the iris. They're smashing it. Absolutely. And so don't overlook having those aquatic plants around these ponds too, because deer, once again, they're going in there. And the cool thing about the aquatic plants is they're filtering out all the nutrients and all the minerals out of that water. And deer know that. So that's actually all that stuff they need. They're going to start feeding on that stuff too. So you can actually kind of pattern them to those aquatic food sources too.
For sure.
So if you find that water and those aquatic food plots, you're in the chips and you're hunting this little hidden gem that once again, everybody just went like, oh, cool. There's plants there. Oh, that sucks. Probably good for duck hunting. That's most common thing I ever hear, right? Is, oh, it's probably good for duck hunting. Oh, well, guess what? It's probably also really good for deer hunting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, dude. That's, that's one of my strategies on public is like, where's the most beat down duck hole around here where
right.
the deer are just oblivious to people, or they just wave right. as guys trudge in with all their decoys and everything. Never see anybody up in a tree. Like, all right, good plan here. Dude, on the note of aquatic vegetation too,
yeah.
those horsetail or yeah. those, whatever they're oh. called.
Yep. Deer
chowing
love
down
them.
On those. Okay.
Oh,
got
yeah.
it. They just, good to know.
I mean, there's, I had one client and they hated it because they had a private pond mm-hmm. that butted up to their hunting land. And there's probably, I bet you their pond, man, probably 1/8 acre of it was that horsetail. And all of it browsed. I mean,
no
mowed. Oh, yeah. The deer absolutely hammer that stuff. You know, because even the guy's like, man, I don't know why you just put a stand here. Deer are always in there feeding. And at the time, I kind of overlooked it because I'm like, it's just horsetail, whatever. And then I started looking, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of activity here. So even horsetail, yeah, they're going to go eat on it. So that's what I mean. That aquatic plant is so nutrient dense that the deer can't help themselves. Like even Dan Perez of Whitetail Properties, years ago, he posted a photo of a deer eating algae out of a pond. Literally had a whole mouthful of algae because there's so much nutrients and richness in there, they can't help themselves.
For sure.
And to me, especially like Northwoods or all that, where there's not a lot of food and you give them that nutrient dense source, they're going to feed on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've heard too, like guys, you know, not hunting over necessarily, but like over in the summer and stuff, seeing deer that are eating like lily pads and some of that, like
oil
that grows up and everything. I never would have thought of that, but yes, I mean, it makes sense too. Like circling back to the duck hunting thing, like you find a creek that's still got a bunch of green vegetation still in it. Like ducks are going to gravitate towards that. Like I'm not, I don't think a buck's going to dunk his head under the creek to get to that stuff, but at least, you know, there's it's a good indicator of what you can expect around those areas. That's super absolutely cool. I love it, dude. That's awesome. Yeah, I can't believe we didn't even talk about food. Too focused on water. But yeah, dude, before we wrap up here, you mentioned you're a big shed hunter. I've been staring at this pile of sheds behind you for this entire conversation. Where are your hot spots as folks head into shed season? When are you going to start looking for them? How can you, like, what do you, or I guess already, now that we're in the first week of March now, is it safe to go in to start, you know, hitting those bedding areas? Do you give them a little bit of extra time? Like, what's your time?
So, like, I've done some walks, and a lot of it's because, like, I'm going on scouting and I got to do videos for content and all that stuff for my own business. But it's one of those things that they're shedding. Right. But I will say, like, right now, my deer are probably at 75% shedded. So there's still, like, my best buck, actually, he's holding tight. I think he's just, he's a pain in my behind. But with that said, it's so it kind of, if you're running cameras, that'll tell your story. But is it a good time? Absolutely. I mean, just make sure that there's no snow on the ground, or pocket snow is terrible. I never want to go out when I just have, like, oh, and here's a 10-foot gap of snow and here's a barrier. That'll mess with your eyes a lot. But I'd say the best thing I ever learned shed hunting is cloudy days are your best friend. Do not take off work on a sunny day and think you're gonna shed hunt. Don't. I mean, I get it if it's the only day you can do, but try to get a cloudy day. That's the day to call in sick to your boss. But I'd say my hot spots, like when I literally look, so like I'm looking all year where my deer are winter feeding, obviously. And I'll find some here and there actually in the food sources. But to me, I'm trying to find, once again, the transition of, all right, how are they walking back to bed? Where's that bed? I find more on those bedding zones than anything. And when I say, like, what are my hot bedding zones? South-facing hills. So they have a lot of sunlight, or areas of pockets that have thermal cover. So, like, if they're near pine trees, or even, like, if there's a saddle or something like that in the layout of the contour, that they are blocked by the wind. And also looking for, like, where their woody browse is, like find out where they're naturally foraging as well. So like you mentioned acorns right now, deer are pawing them all up everywhere. In Northwoods, that's where you find a lot of sheds, honestly, is in those areas where they're ripping those acorns apart, because they're constantly pawing and they're hoofing and antlers are falling off. But the other time too is, like, look for those edges of timber. Because a lot of times when deer are feeding, let's say in a food source, when they're out there all night, they'll go back to that edge of the timber. They're not going to go all the way back to their bed, but they're bedding on the edge of timber. So I find a lot there, or like where the sun's hitting, where the grass transition is into the field. Fence jumpers is another one. If you know where there's old fence lines and all that, major deer trails, look for those. Sometimes those are the best spots to look at. You're like, and there it is, right on the other side of the, hopefully it's on the perfect side of the fence, not the neighbor's side where you're like, well, that sucks. I got to walk away, walk away mad. But no, so I mean, to me, bulk of my antlers, I'd say, are usually bedding zone antlers. That's more common than anything. Yeah. The easy ones, as I call them, are the ones in the food plus where you're like, oh, they're sweet. There's a shed. But most often not, you're just looking at a bunch of deer crap and a bunch of sign that the deer were there, but their antlers aren't there. So bedding zones, thick cover. I like prickly ash. I found a lot of sheds in prickly ash. For whatever reason, I just feel like the deer prefer that bedding, because there's not they can kind of rabbit hole themselves in there, but they have sunlight still hitting them and they're browsing in there and things that way. But I found a lot in prickly ash for whatever reason. But even there too, avoid the really thick stuff. Like, guys will get really excited about a big pine plantation or cedar thicket. Well, if you go in there and you feel like you're getting in there like a rabbit, they're not in there. So don't even waste your time hands and knees crawling, because you're not going to stumble. You'll probably stumble like on a dead rabbit before you'll a deer antler. They have to go through and feel like they can maneuver through it.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great distinction in terms of like everybody looks for the thickest, nastiest crap.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, what would I not want? It's like, well, within reason. Yes, yes. Yeah, I love it, dude. That's awesome. Well, man. Dude, this has been fantastic, dude. I feel like we're gonna have to get you back on here later this
absolutely.
Year or some other time, and just keep picking your brain, dude. I could talk to you forever, but I know it's getting late, and this is your second podcast of the day, so I'm sure you're getting burned out on them. But
one guy I help stuff with, he always tells me, he's like, "Oh, so you started your media tour?" I'm like, "Absolutely." So it's, well, to me, it's like, because obviously one of my business is like I got to fill in the voids where I'm in an office day, so I fill in with podcasts and.
Mm-hmm.
To me, as hunters, there's always something to learn. And it goes for myself. Like, yeah, I do habitat work, but I still learn from other guys that do habitat work or other biologists, whatever it might be. But there's always a time to learn. And to me, I always want to educate on water because that was the world I knew for 20 years. And guys are getting excited about it finally, which I'm happy about. But there's a lot to learn for everyone about water. So like, to me, that's my thing I can provide to the hunting community. While we learn from everyone else on every other idea or stance there is.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure you see it more so than maybe my perception or but I feel like there's certain like trendy practices and stuff. Like for years
big
ago,
time.
I mean, now last year, 2 years ago, it was the big rope scrape. And before that,
it was
the grapevine and like all that stuff or whatever. So yeah, I'm glad that, that the water hole has some merit behind it beyond, buying a big blue rope and, spraying, dumping a bottle of something on it. Yeah.
Dub slime and all these different little things that have been out there. Right?
Yeah. Yep,
absolutely. No, it's one of those things that to me, it can be part of everybody's strategy, whether you're public or private. Private, yeah, you have upper hand because you can actually introduce it. But to me, keep that in your back pocket because to me, it's one of the highest priority items on the list when it comes to hunting.
Definitely, man. Well, dude, where can folks go if they want to get in touch with you about doing some consulting and follow along with what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm on every social media there pretty much is. So Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, so Creek Bottom Land Management on all those. But then also my website, creekbottomlandmgmt.com. And honestly, if everyone has questions, reach out to me. I'm one of those guys, I want to give more information out. And I give free information out all the time just to help. End of the day, we're all hunters. We all want to put more deer on the wall. And to me, that's the important part of this.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. I love it. Well, dude, this has been awesome, man. I appreciate the heck out of your time. And I've got some projects starting to form themselves in my brain right now that I might be shooting you a text about. What is wrong with what I'm doing right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but dude, this has been awesome, man. I seriously appreciate your time. And man. Good. Are you going to be out turkey hunting this year?
Absolutely.
We didn't even.
Yep. Nope. I'm consulting. I mean, Wisconsin wise, I pound it nonstop. I have a bunch of nephews, a son, and all that. So I go
sweet
turkey hunting crazy. But this year, I'm excited. I'm going potentially going out west to get a Miriam.
Sick. Where are you going?
Yeah. So I'm going to Montana and we're doing Colorado or Wyoming. I don't know. We're doing one of those two. But
nice.
What's nice is where we're going, it's only 40 minutes away from the Montana line. So you can literally hunt birds one day in one state, kill. Hop the line and go for more birds. But my dilemma is then I'm at 3 or 4 of the state's birds. So then I'd have to go and get to Osceola. So I just.
Yeah, you got to go at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. The wife will just have to understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, dude, good luck this spring, man. And stay in touch, dude. This is awesome.
Awesome.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Pierce.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show, and if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.